Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. I'm Reeve Hamilton here with CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve.
Reporter Brandy Grissom.
Hey, Reeve.
And Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune.
Hello. Brandy's with the Tribune, too.
Well, that's implied. You're sort of an outlier.
Ben, you start making trouble. I'm going to come at you like a spider monkey, I promise.
And all of us here from the Tribune, we're going to be talking about Twitter politics today, the state's changing demographics, and Brandy's going to give us an update on innocence legislation.
Good.
So if we just get started, you know, the big news out of the Oscars was the King's speech, and the big news out of Texas this week was the governor's Twitter.
The governor's diss.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
You know, basically, a reporter from the Dallas Morning News went to look at Governor Perry's Twitter account.
This would be Tom Benning.
Benning, right. And realized that he had been blocked by Governor Perry. And since this is Governor Perry's personal Twitter account that his staff says he manages himself, Governor Perry would have had to single him out as someone he wanted to block. And then some other reporters went to look, and they found Bud Kennedy from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram is blocked, Rick Dunham from the Houston Chronicle.
Theodore Kim from the Dallas Morning News came forward and said, I, too, have been blocked by the
Scott
governor.
Braddock from KRLD. Mm-hmm. And the Washington Post picked this up.
Right. You know, these are not exactly Bob Moser and Dave Mann of The Observer. I mean, these are not partisan. Bob Moser and Dave Mann or Bob Moser and Dave Mann. But the point is, these are not exactly partisan journalists who are being blocked.
Bud Kennedy is a columnist.
Bud Kennedy isn't partisan.
But he has views sometimes.
way to make your case.
The big question is, does this warrant the coverage? Does this warrant getting picked up in the Washington Post? Is this
and
a
Politico
moment worth noting?
Right. And KUTnews.org?
Is that even a website?
Stop pimping for your website,
sorry,
Brandy.
Sorry.
This is my website.
Yes, sir.
Brandy, what do you think about that?
Well, I just think it says maybe it's just another way for Governor Perry to show sort of his thoughts about the media in general. He hasn't always been necessarily very friendly. And I think that he's shown that he thinks a lot of us have very distinct opinions, whether we like to say that we show them or not.
Or whether, in fact, we even have them.
Right.
Right. Are you blocked?
I haven't checked, actually.
Are you blocked, Ben?
No.
Are you blocked, Revo?
No, but a fake Governor Perry did threaten to block me. A joke account.
I'm just worried about being blocked by staffer move. That's the one that concerns me, actually.
The thing about it is that this is his personal account. He has official government accounts. And even if you are blocked, you can still see his whole feed. I mean, it's a public feed.
Well, you know, and I thought that was interesting. That you know, you talk about is somebody partisan, is that why they're being blocked? I thought that some of the columns on this were a little ridiculous. There was one, maybe it was Politico, maybe it was Washington Post blog, saying, you know, oh, Governor Perry, you're blocking people, but guess what? They can still see you. Governor Perry tweets a lot. I'm pretty sure he knows that they can still. I mean, you know, they were making the case that, well, the governor doesn't even realize that they can still see. I'm pretty sure he knows.
He just doesn't want to see them. He finds them annoying.
I mean, I also, I kind of.
Why them?
See, well, I don't
what
know.
Did they do?
We don't know. We know that Governor Perry tweets a lot. We don't know for sure that he really knows what all the buttons do. You know, do you think he really knows what the block button means?
I'd like to make, but this is a confidential to Mark Miner. I have no idea who this is. I agree. just don't worry about, don't block me, block him, don't hold us all responsible.
Maybe he didn't like what Bud Kennedy was saying about restaurants in Fort Worth and Dallas.
Well, that's the thing. The other person that's blocked Bud Kennedy is a bakery owner who thinks that Bud Kennedy prefers a different bakery. It's possible that Rick Perry is a fan of that bakery.
You never know.
And you wonder why they say the media only cares about crap.
Well, you know, I did think that there was one interesting debate that came out of this, which was the idea of, what does it mean to have access in a new media world? And, you know, I posted this on the KUT blog, sorry. But, you know, I was like, you know, it's one thing to be denied an interview by the governor. It's another thing, you know, you can easily argue that it's not a great thing if you get kicked off of his press office's email list. But is it a denial of access that you are blocked from his personal account if you are then able to get on, and this is another layer of crap, but if you are able to get on his official governor's Twitter account and his campaign Twitter account?
What is the difference if you're blocked by the governor? I just don't see what the issue is.
I
want to go back to even an earlier part of this, which is, do you believe that the governor is actually tweeting on the governor's Twitter account?
I'm pretty sure he is.
What evidence do you have of
that?
Pictures of his dogs.
His family events. You know, he went backstage at a Broadway play that was here in Austin, and he put up a tweet pic of him with the cast of the play.
I can't even put up a tweet pic. Are you are you sure that this is not a staff member?
I was at
we're just not sure you know how to take photos.
There's no way you can. I mean,
I was at the Republican Governors Association meeting here in Lost Pines last year.
Right.
And he was sitting on stage, and all these Republican governors all of a sudden started talking about Twitter as if it was something they had just discovered. Perry pulls out his BlackBerry, takes a picture, sits there, and 5 minutes later, I had my tweet deck open, and boom, there was a picture with Perry saying,
okay, so
they're talking about Twitter.
So you believe he does
personally? I do believe
personally
that he, on that personal one, absolutely.
But do you believe he actually made the pre-went, Tom Benning.
I don't know about that.
I think I'll block him. I mean, I'm just having a hard time understanding how all this happened.
Right, and his staff, you know, all they'll say, well, it's his personal thing. He can do what he wants with it. So, they're not talking, and there's nowhere to, you can't read his mind on it, and there's no pattern to the people. Honestly, I just thought the outrage over it was a bit extreme.
I thought that the, use a word, the liberal bloggers who said, you know, I was blocked.
That's two words.
Well, okay. But, you know, the people that got outraged because they were blocked, and they're, you know,
right,
progressive, liberal, whatever,
this
Democratic
was like
bloggers.
Catherine Hanschen of the Burn Orange Report.
Well,
Mean
Rachel.
Rachel Ferris.
Well, why would
blocked.
Governor Perry want to see what those people have to say?
Exactly. I mean,
thing is, if they have something to say to him, they can still at him and he'll still see it. They just can't get his feeds feeded into their Twitter stream, and I'm not sure that that is a right.
Yeah. That's right.
Right.
Seems like a fair end to this conversation.
Yeah. Well, then let's move on to other things that happened on Monday. Other than the big news about Governor Perry's Twitter was the Texas Tribune's New Day Rising event over at UT.
Right, 300 or so people over the course of the day were just absolutely wrapped. Look, we did a nice program, I thought, on Monday. I can say that with Steve Murdoch, the former state demographer and head of the U.S. Census Bureau, and Henry Cisneros, the former mayor of San Antonio. We had four state representatives, Larry Gonzalez and Veronica Gonzalez, Mike Villarreal, and Aaron Pena, and some great policy folks and some political consultants. And we talked about the question of changing demographics in politics and policy on the heels of the release of the census numbers. And by the time you see this or hear this podcast on the Tribune site, we'll have a story up by Matt Stiles and Ryan Murphy that breaks down county by county in Texas the change in the Hispanic population across all 254 counties. And you can see that, you know, this is not a question of whether the train is leaving the station, the train is left. And, you know, we in Texas need to either be on it and accept the fact that that change is coming, or we need to be left back at the station. And I think the conversation was very productive in terms of understanding what the landscape looks like going forward. And I took away a couple things, Reeve. One was that public education is kind of at the epicenter of every conversation. So whether you're talking about demographic change as it affects Texas in the area of workforce development or in the area of healthcare or in the area of the pipeline to higher ed, it all comes back to public education. And to have this change, such an issue, overlaid on top of the budget cuts that are coming for public education, everyone is just focusing back on public education and whether those cuts to public education are going to leave a generation of Texans, mostly young and mostly Hispanic, behind. And that was the substantive part of the conversation among the state legislators was, you know, are we putting more at risk than, you know, a specific teacher's job or a specific administrator's job if we talk about cutting public ed by this much? In fact, the reverberations will be felt several years and decades down the road.
Well, there's sort of – I mean, every problem the state is facing is sort of a problem for the Hispanic community, given that that's the majority – going to be the majority of the state. As sort of that's the takeaway, right?
Right, but I think public education people perceive to be the biggest.
Well, and Murdoch, who I'm a huge fan of Murdoch, you go to one of his speeches, he talks numbers and statistics, and I stay wide awake the entire time and I'm rapt. He just does a great job delivering all this stuff. But, you know, he for years has been saying, look, it's very simple, talking about the Hispanic population. Traditionally, we don't educate them as well as we educate the white population. And guess what? Now they're going to be the majority. So does that mean we're going to have a majority of Texans that we don't educate very well? What is that going to mean for us?
Right. And, of course, you on the criminal justice stuff, Brandy, it's got huge implications for that.
Well, I think one of the biggest implications is in politics is voting. I mean, we don't see Hispanic voting turnout very high at all right now in cities like El Paso and other cities along the border. And so are they having any say in all these cuts that are happening to public education that and criminal justice and all these other areas of the budget that are going to be impacting them, you know, more than anyone else down the line? What's their say going to be, and how are they going to turn that around to where they do have more power?
Well, on the subject of voting, we do have this audio clip from this week's voter ID hearings, which is an issue that people argue affects minority communities more than others. And it was contentious last session, and it's still contentious this session. Here you have Gary Bledsoe of the NAACP testifying, and State Representative Rafael Anchia, who is sitting in on the hearing, is going to jump in.
If you look at the numbers of voters that we have today,
Mr. Chairman, just real quickly, I apologize, Mr. Bledsoe. I'm very distracted. Mr. Green in the front row keeps mouthing the words bullshit over and over again. I find it extremely offensive. As he is, as Mr. Bledsoe is trying to testify here, I saw it once, I let it go. You've done it twice, so I'd ask that you admonish members of the audience not to be disrespectful to the people who are testifying.
And so, as you can hear, I mean, it's getting pretty heated in there, and you already have some lawmakers have called this because of some of the immigration legislation, including voter ID, and the fact that cuts to financial aid for higher ed students and public education things will disproportionately affect minority populations. They're calling it the most racist session in decades.
Well, in fact, Lon Burnham specifically has referred to it as the most racist session in decades, and he's not alone in believing that, although I have to tell you, voter ID, from this vantage point, seems like the most moderate legislation affecting the Hispanic community of all the stuff that's in consideration right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just look at some of the, you know, we had that really interesting interview with Leo Berman that Ton did earlier in the week or late last week. And, I mean, you're just listening to some of the stuff that he's putting out. Yeah, this looks like a little walk in the park.
The midpoint of the debate has baseline shifted to the right, that the middle is now where the right used to be. We've reset the middle, basically.
You know, you were talking though about the kind of underlying consequence of this session. You know, maybe being that a next generation is not educated as well, and Texas isn't better off. I think it's also then. So the political side of that is this a session where Republicans can not set themselves up in the future as well with some of this legislation?
Look, I think that the real question is going to be these six Republican state legislators. We had none last session. We have six now. Are they going to be able to go back home and
the Hispanic
Republicans and talk to their constituents in a way that get them reelected? If they're advocating for policies, in the case of the members who have Hispanics in their districts, everybody has Hispanics to some degree, but there are some districts that have more Hispanics than others. And I would note Aaron Pena, who switched parties from Democrat to Republican this year.
And who's on that voter ID committee.
And his position on that in the hearing was sort of interesting, right? He said, you know, this only affects voter impersonation, and there are surely not hordes of voter impersonators heading to the polls.
He was kind of knocking down some of the, I guess,
which basically is the whole argument for voter ID, but he also says, but I will be supporting voter ID.
But he'll support it. Look, everybody in the legislature, every member in the legislature, not just Hispanics and not just Republicans, has to ask himself and herself, do I represent my party? Do I represent my race or gender? Or do I represent my district? And so for Pena, who made a very conscious, this is a smart guy, very conscious decision to switch parties, when he goes back home to run again as a Republican in a district that's 70% Hispanic and has always been a deep-in-the-woods Democratic district, he has to ask himself if I faithfully represent my district at the legislative session or not. And maybe back home, Reeve, there's a groundswell for voter impersonation legislation. Maybe there is. You know, we asked Larry Gonzalez the other day, would you support Debbie Riddle's bill to require school districts to determine the citizenship status of students that enrolled? And he basically said, hell no, I'm not going to support anything that smacks of racial profiling. Well, Mr. Gonzalez, Mr. Aliceta, Mr. Torres, Mr. Margot, Mr. Pena, you guys, Mr. Garza, you're all going to have to make a decision at times when those bills come up. Do you represent your party or do you represent your constituents? I'm not sure that you can do both right now and not pay a price.
I think you have to consider also that the Hispanics aren't monolithic, like we were talking about earlier. When I reported in El Paso, there were plenty of Hispanics who said, you know, they were for voter ID because they were worried about new immigrants coming in illegally, and they had been here for years, and they had done it the quote-unquote right way, and their family had done it the quote-unquote right way. And so there's that sort of internal tension even within the Hispanic population, and, you know, they align really well with some of the conservative values, especially on social issues.
Abortion is a great example where Hispanic Catholics are often more with the Republicans than the Democrats on that issue.
Well, and I just think it's not the right way to go when you have when you see the press releases coming out day after day saying, well, because you are this, you have to believe this. Because you are this, you have to vote this way. And it doesn't. I don't think it works with the voter ID in Hispanics, Republican Hispanics. I don't think it works with African Americans, whites, you know, rural city. It's just everyone wants to paint you into a corner on all sides, I think, now in the political climate that we're in. And it doesn't work.
Right.
But hey, we love covering it. Just wanted to get an upbeat thing there.
Right. Well, nice save, Ben.
Thank you. Yes, yes.
Well, and Brandy loves covering Innocence Legislation, so let's talk about that a little bit.
Love it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, abortion, voter ID, those are the big sort of bills that we are hearing about. But there's also a bill that's sort of near and dear to many hearts, I think, that has been sort of steadily progressing so far this session. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It's a bill that would require sort of uniform standards for eyewitness identification evidence in cases across the state. And the folks at the Innocence Project of Texas and other sort of criminal justice advocates have really been saying that this bill is one of the most important moves toward limiting the number of wrongful convictions in Texas that we've seen in a number of years. This bill is one that came out of the Timothy Cole legislative recommendation panels. Basically, what we've seen in Texas is of all the 40-some wrongful convictions that we've identified up to this point, 70 to 80% of them, depending on who you talk to, have resulted from an erroneous eyewitness identification.
Right.
And so what we saw at the committee hearings, both in the Senate and in the House, was basically just a line of these ex-inmates who had spent years behind bars, wrongfully convicted, telling their stories about how the person who testified against them just plain got it wrong. In one case, James Giles was identified by someone who had been attacked by someone with the same name as him, but they just got it wrong. And it turns out the person who attacked this woman was actually about a decade younger than him, but just had the same name. And he spent years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit.
And, well, with Anthony Graves this week, who we reported on, you know, he was ID'd by the guy that committed the, by a person who was convicted of and put to death for committing the murder. So, I mean,
right.
You know, that's a rough ID to take and end up in jail for 18 years with.
I mean, the problem is that the system is not very well situated to deal with these claims of innocence. We know this. We've seen it over the years. There are people who've spent, I mean, I think at a certain point after Craig Watkins had his whole initiative out of the Dallas County DA's office, we had a certain number, maybe 35 or 36 people who'd been exonerated, and they'd spent something like 530 years in jail and in total. And many of them had been talking about how they were innocent for years. I mean, Anthony Graves is a great example. How long has Anthony Graves talked about the fact that he was innocent? I mean, how long did Cameron Willingham talk about the fact that he was innocent? And you know what? There are people who claim they're innocent who are not innocent. We know this. It's a truism. But there needs to be a system in place to evaluate these guys on the front end and then compensate them for wrongful prosecution and wrongful incarceration on the back end. And we don't have it right yet.
And so I think what we're seeing this week is efforts to address that on both ends. So we have the eyewitness identification bill that passed out of both the House and Senate committees. Will go to both chambers, potentially, you know, pass. It passed in the Senate last session. And then on the other end, on the compensation end, we have Anthony Graves, who is fighting to get the money that he's owed for all the years that he did serve behind bars.
And what's the holdup there?
So he applied... He applied to Secretary or to Comptroller Combs for money he's supposed to get. I think it's $80,000 for each year that he spent.
One lump sum of that, so that's about $1.4 million.
Right.
And then an annuity
on
top
of
that.
But Combs has said that she can't accept his application because the order dismissing his charges isn't worded correctly. It has to have been dismissed because of actual innocence, and the order says something like there wasn't enough evidence to prove the charges.
So can't we just get a new order? I mean, no one is disputing the facts of his exoneration.
So that's what they're trying to do.
They're doing both. They're trying to do that, and at the same time, they're suing to have the courts maybe, because they say, you know, the lawyers about this, I mean, yeah, sure, they want to win this case, but they were very pleasant about it, actually. They said, you know, look, we think the comptroller made a mistake. It's not her fault. The agencies have to interpret the laws based on the rules that they're given. under what this bill said. She thought she was interpreting it the way that she was supposed to, and you know that just what
basically what no one's wrong, right?
You know, well, no except one, that he wants to admit
well,
that
they well, well, made the, a mistake. You know, you're dealing with a big bureaucracy, and the unfortunate thing about dealing with a big bureaucracy is it often acts like a big bureaucracy. On the other hand, you look at Anthony Graves, no one questions whether he's innocent except maybe the DA who prosecuted him. I mean, at this point, I'm not even sure that people back home would agree that he's guilty or would say that he's guilty. And you think, whatever it takes for the state to move mountains, give this guy what he's due and let him move on with the rest of his life.
Right.
You know, you don't have to be soft on crime to believe that.
Right. So, you know, they're asking a judge to sign a new order that basically says this guy is actually innocent, give him his money. And then he can, apply again to Combs and, you know, get what the money that's coming to him. And, you know, the Innocence Project says, look, this guy is being pretty, you know, generous and easy on the state. He spent, you know, almost two decades behind bars for a crime he didn't commit, and he could sue your pants off. But he's taking $1.4 million in an annuity, so...
Yeah, the lawsuit doesn't ask for any more than what he should be getting under the law.
I have to believe that there can be common ground between and among people of different ideological stripes on this, because nobody wants a justice system that puts innocent people away. You want a justice system that puts guilty people away. And by acknowledging innocence, you don't undermine the process of putting guilty people behind bars. You just don't.
And if Texas wants to remain, you know, the strong on crime state that has a, I don't know how you would phrase it, a fairly healthy execution system, you have to
robust.
Robust, thank you. Robust, you know.
It's having problems at the moment.
Technically, Ben, it's unhealthy.
Well, that's true. If you're going to do that, you have
getting
to.
It's necessary materials, right?
But if you're going to do that, you have to make sure that you're making sure that everyone who is not innocent, and so they have to be strong.
I mean, the fact is that for all these people who've been exonerated, someone committed that crime.
Right.
And that person who committed the crime has been out among us all these years, potentially committing other crimes, likely committing other crimes. So the people who are quite law and order focused ought to be thrilled to have somebody who's innocent out of jail so that the process to find the person who's guilty can really begin.
I think the bigger debate here that we're sort of seeing bubbling up close to the surface is just how big of a problem is wrongful conviction in Texas? And, you know, are people exaggerating the problem? Or, you know, I mean, we convict hundreds of thousands of people every year of crimes, and we have, you know, a smaller number of people who we found innocent. So, you know, how big is this problem? Is this a small section, or is it being overblown? And what do we do about it besides just, you know, eyewitness identification and how
right,
you
address
other issues?
We pass this session if we do pass it, but it's not a fix.
Well, it comes back to DNA testing. It comes back to the rights and the opportunities for people who claim innocence and are behind bars to have evidence that was taken at the time of the crime and the conviction tested against evidence today with current technology. I mean, part of the issue in a number of these cases is that people were convicted at a time when the technology did not exist to verify that they were innocent using evidence collected at the crime scene. Now there is the opportunity to collect and test evidence using new technology, and whether or not the new technology and the new systems are going to be applied. I mean, there's a lot of complicated issues here.
Well, it comes down to an examination of really of the entire clemency process and whether it's adequate, and if people who are actually innocent and behind bars have adequate opportunity to prove that in Texas. And if you look at, you know, questions that come before the Board of Pardons and Paroles and how often they consider applications, and then how often Perry considers their recommendations and approves them, which is about 30% of the time, then there are questions about, you know, do people really have an opportunity to prove their case after they've been convicted.
And we should hope, regardless of party, we should hope that people have an opportunity to make their case and to prove it if they have
right.
a case to prove.
But is there anyone making the case that the scope doesn't matter? That, you know, if this just happens to one person, then we have a problem? Or does it have to reach a critical mass to be a problem?
The problem with that, I'm sympathetic to that point of view up to a point. The problem is that, you know, the margin of error for anything is going to, I mean, look, innocent people have been put to death over the years, in Texas, full stop. There's nothing you can do about that. Nobody can dispute it. It's not a great thing. It's not even a good thing. I wish it were not the case. I bet we all wish it were not the case. But the problem is that any system like this is going to make some mistakes. The question is whether the reason that we make mistakes has been so institutionalized that now, as a matter of course, we're making mistakes. And do we care that we're making mistakes? And if we can avoid making them, then we should avoid making them.
Right. Well, if anyone out there has questions or comments about that or some crime tips, then they can send them to podcasts.
You have been wrongly accused of a crime.
By an eyewitness account.
Right.
Email freeme@reedhamilton.net.
It's podcasts@texastribune.org, or you can block us on Twitter at Texas Tribune. On behalf of Evan, Brandy, Ben, and our producer, Todd, I'm Reeve Hamilton. This has been the Tribcast. Thanks for listening.